Welcome to Women in Translation, an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more.
In this episode, host Joe Williams talks with Bosnian UK author and translator Vesna Marić. Joe started by asking Vesna to introduce herself.
I'm originally from the Yugoslavia, what was Yugoslavia, and is now Bosnia Herzegovina. Although I've been out of Bosnia for 30 years now. So I went to the UK as a refugee, an asylum seeker, later on a refugee in 1992. So it's actually a 30-year anniversary of my exile. Shall I make it very dramatic? Sound very dramatic. So yes, I lived in the Lake District for the first year, then I lived in Exeter, then I lived in Hull, and then I spent in London. I also went back to Bosnia to work for a couple of years to teach in an international college. That was an interesting experience as well. Yeah, that's more or less. And the work I do, I'm a writer and a journalist. I spent many years writing travel guides, which of course now with the pandemic is a little bit on the dead side. And I also work as a translator from Croatian to English. Yeah, I do a lot of things at the same time.
Thank you. So there's a couple of things I'd like to touch on here. As you say, you were a refugee asylum seeker when you left Bosnia, and that, as I understand it, was to do with the outbreak of conflict in Bosnia, and that was your motivation for leaving. You were very young, but you must have some kind of vague recollection of the conflict or the conditions under which you left. Is that experience, that memory, something you've tried to deal with in your literary work? Is that something that you feel is still present? I don't know, in your personality, your psychology?
Yeah, my first book, Bluebird, is about my journey from Bosnia to the UK, and published in the UK, and had quite a good run in all kinds of spaces in the British media. But so yes, it defines most of my work, which I would say runs along sort of political lines, and it deals a lot with belonging and migration, and war. And there's a war going on. I'm usually like the person that can write something about it, unfortunately. But that's how it is. Is it something? Of course, I think this kind of migration in general defines your life for the rest of your days. Even if you go back to your country, still having lived abroad for such a long time, you're never kind of a person of one heritage. And you said I was not a native speaker, but I feel entirely bilingual, and so it doesn't even having gone to the UK at the age of 16. You're not really a child, but you're not really an adult either. And the way you can immerse yourself in another culture at that age is quite different. And of course, it shaped me in fundamental ways. Both being a migrant, trying to fit in, that means 30 years later, even going back to Bosnia, it was really interesting to see that I'm from there, but in many ways I'm not anymore, you know. So yeah, it marks you.
Yeah, absolutely interesting what you say about that kind of experience, perhaps producing a person who doesn't really have any very firm, fixed idea of belonging and where's home and where are you from, because you feel like you're a migrant to your new adopted country of the UK, and you're not necessarily Bosnian anymore either, because you've left and you've lived abroad. So there's a kind of a difficulty in feeling a clear sense of connection and belonging. And it's not a simple answer. It's something that Stuart Hall, the cultural theorist, said is quite common. One of the conditions or indicators of a very modern, developed society is that when you ask a person where they're from, it's not a one-word answer anymore. You get told a story, is the way that he puts it. Even I'm from the UK, and I've never been forced from my home due to conflict, but I've been living abroad. I left the UK when I was 25 to go and work abroad, and I've been working abroad basically on and off since then, and just having brief stints in the UK. So yeah, although I'm UK, I'm basically English, I'm also not that English. I'm resident in Portugal now, and you know, hopefully be getting citizenship in the future. For very different reasons, I can identify to a certain extent with some of what you're saying. The other thing I wanted to mention, you say you translate Croatian into English, and that was another thing I wanted to talk about as well, is the fact that you've mastered your second language, English, to such an extent that you now translate into that language and now write novels and fiction and journalism in that language too. That's something I really want to talk about later. But you were born in Bosnia, you left Bosnia, but you translate Croatian.
It's actually a very complicated thing that's obviously very much connected to the war and the nationalist sort of politics, but your general difference between Bosnian, Serbian and Croatian. It's a controversial thing, but it's also really not at the same time. The differences between English and American English and Australian, there's a vast difference in accents, but in general, people can communicate without needing any help to understand each other. So this is in terms of sort of literary Croatian. I don't think I would necessarily be able to translate into it because it's changed a lot since the 90s. They've really worked on, it's a bit like I studied Czech literature and the Czechs at the beginning, I think, of the 19th or 20th century, I can't even remember, but they changed their whole language to fit in with, to take any foreign influences out and put it all into sort of as Slavic root as possible. And I think the Croats kind of tried to do the same, which resulted in many hilarious constructions. Something like a belt was, there were jokes, it was called like the round the belt, round the waist holding up trouser thing. So it was a bit, if to give you an idea of how this thing has worked, the Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian, more or less all the same thing. A lot of people don't agree with this, but it's definitely there. You can see people talking to each other, cracking jokes, having a coffee, doing everything perfectly fine, which to me is enough evidence that it's the same language.
Sure. Yeah, it's very interesting what you said about sometimes the distinctions being reflections of political identity. Sometimes the distinctions between a language is sometimes very politically motivated and artificial, ultimately, and is imposed basically to try and legitimize certain political programs, perhaps. Celia Hawksworth, the translator, yeah, she was telling me that she used to teach what was called Serbo-Croat back in the day, which is now Bosnian or something like this. So yeah, they're very fluctuating, these distinctions. Kind of arbitrary, depending on what the political climate is, I suppose. That seems to be what it looks like to me, at least, anyway. Okay, so to move on to your writing work then. So you arrived in the UK, in the north of England, of all places, in the Lake District, which has obviously got a fine literary pedigree. That was obviously, it's a very literary place. Hull as well, you went to, which is not so much. But anyway, you became a professional writer. So writing was always a living to you. How did you become a professional writer, as making a living writing travel books or journalism? How did you fall into that?
Well, it was something I always wanted to do since I was a child. I wanted to do it. It was basically what was my main interest in literature. So I studied, as I said, Czech literature in London, and I started working at the World Service, the BBC World Service, and then I started working as a sound editor. So we used to cut tape with razors and stick it back together. So it was pre-digital, kind of, at least the World Service. And then I got into doing some radio scripts and things like this. And then a friend of mine from university started working for Lonely Planet Travel Guides. And I thought, let me try and apply. And they basically accepted my radio scripts as published work, which it was. So that was it, really. I applied and I got this job. And then at some point, I got made redundant from the BBC because they were closing down post 9/11. They were closing down a lot of the foreign services. And I wrote my first book in kind of jobless state and between Lonely Planet jobs and post BBC. I was a little bit unemployed, which gave me the time.
So on the subject of Bluebird, then, this is a memoir, in a sense, of your experiences of being a teenager in that kind of, like you say, that a stage of life where you're probably quite confused anyway. Your sense of self is formed to an extent, but it's still very much in formation and it's going through changes and this kind of thing. So into that situation, into that picture, then happens this very seismic shift in your surroundings and you're forced to leave Bosnia and relocate to the north of England. And you write a book about that experience, which is called Bluebird, which I haven't read. I've read The President's Shop, which we're going to talk about later. But like you say, Bluebird has been very positively and favourably reviewed. And the title itself sticks out to me because refugee and war refugee memoirs, it's not a light-hearted subject matter. It's quite a dark theme. But Bluebird, to me, that title evokes something less sad, like it's not a process of migration. The migrant experience is perhaps not hopeless and there's something positive or celebratory about it. Maybe that's an undue inference. Could you perhaps elaborate a little bit on Bluebird, the meaning of the title and what you were hoping to capture with the book?
Bluebird comes from that Vera Lynn song, There'll Be Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover. And the reason for that was because we entered the UK from Calais to Dover. So there were the white cliffs of Dover and this song. But yeah, it's definitely not super heavy memoir, I would say. It's humor in it, which, I mean, really was how I remember. It was a really difficult time. But so there were also a lot of really absurd, surreal situations, which is how I experienced this journey. And like the time there in Bosnia, humor was and is a great way of coping. As a friend of mine once said, there's nothing more humorous than staring into the dark, deep darkness of life. So I think this is something that's really a huge part of our culture. And it was just genuinely, there was some really funny situations. So what I wanted to do, and I think this is the experience of a lot of people who migrate, actually, to be honest, right now, this is a really funny, like weird topic to talk about because of Ukraine and this response to white refugees versus all these people of color who've been like stuck at Europe's borders for years. In fact, Bosnia is full of migrants, as they're called, who nobody wants to admit into Europe. So 92 was a really very different time to be a migrant. And I didn't for years really understand the impact of what it meant to be white as a refugee. I was completely just in that space of having lost the whole, you know, our entire lives. So I didn't think any of us really, in a way, that weird privilege of being a white immigrant is, it sounds like a weird word to use, privilege, but definitely is there, right? When you see the level at which it can be inhumane. I don't know, to me it starts to become quite, how can I say, beyond what I consider comprehensible behavior. So what I wanted to write about, to depict with Bluebird, was that it can happen to anyone, that it can happen to anyone to become this kind of refugee, and the fact that it's all about how you're perceived. So in a way, we were suddenly perceived as something that we'd never considered ourselves to be, which is Eastern European, for example, because we didn't think of ourselves as Eastern Europeans. I mean, we still don't know what it means in terms of identity, but geographically and from a British perspective, I understand what it implies. And in terms of being a refugee, again, it's like, what are you? So there were all these filters that were suddenly between us and our fellow human beings who were not from Bosnia. And this in itself was a very sort of disorienting experience. And there was this huge pressure, which I don't think I appreciated until recently. There was a massive pressure I put on myself to really adapt, because I understood that if I didn't adapt, that if I was sort of more foreign than British, I would have a difficult time getting on in this new society. So there was a lot in there, because also I was so young. I was with other teenagers. So in some ways, it was much easier to adapt, because it's a sort of nation. Like I always say, this is a nation unto itself, being a teenager, at least in Europe, let's put it that way. It was easier in some ways. In other ways, it was a lot more imperative for me. I don't think I felt I had any kind of choice. And yeah, it was a complex time. But I think my desire was to say, look, this is a human experience. It can happen to anybody. And let's really take care of how we treat each other when these labels applied, which, as I said, now in 2022, 30 years later, is wow. You know, it's incredible to see this response.
Absolutely. Thank you for that answer. And you've said a few things here that I want to try and connect. So the first thing that I'd like to start with is humor, because I read The President's Shop, which is your recent novel, which came out on Sandoff Passage last year, I think in 2021. And that has humor in it, that has satire, and that has dark humor, and that looks for humor in dark places. And just briefly, as an aside at this point, for quite different reasons, that's something that people in the UK are also quite familiar with and quite okay with people doing, I think, is looking for humor in a place which is perhaps not where you would not necessarily expect to find humor available there easily, is low hanging fruit. Obviously, for very different reasons, you know, we've not been, you know, had our lives turned upside down by conflict, but for whatever reason, we do appreciate to an extent dark humor.
Yeah, it's what I also appreciate about the UK. Yeah.
And then the other thing that you mentioned, there's something absurd about the migrant experience, just the absurdity of what was going on with the war and the migration. And I definitely felt those moments of the absurd in The President's Shop, your novel, which treats a kind of fictionalized Balkan nation unnamed, which is a kind of agglomeration of many Balkan nations, maybe, I don't know, in which there is this absurd notion of this personality cult which has sprung up around this unnamed president. And there's this kind of level of absurdity to do with the devotion and the adoration which the people treat him and the mythic status he holds. And there's some absurdity and humor both within that. So that's the connection I wanted to make there between what you were talking about and the president's shop. Then, of course, there was teenage years, and you just mentioned that teenage years were like a nation to themselves, because in the president's shop, there were two teenage characters who were very sympathetic characters. They're both struggling with their sexual identity and how to give expression to that in the context in which they find themselves. So your book definitely deals with that confused period of adolescence and growing up within a specific kind of context, in that political climate of zealous, almost chauvinistic nationalism and a kind of devotion to your country, like a religious devotion to a leader. And all of that comes across there. So we'll talk then about the book. And lastly, the last thing I wanted to try and connect with was your background as a journalist seems to infiltrate and seems to have made its mark in the style of the book, because there is a certain sort of journalistic style to the book. There's some quite poetic parts in there too. One thing that kind of struck me a bit, and I love this kind of writing, this is not like a value judgment that I'm about to say here. Some of my favorite writing is that kind of documentary journalism style, which is quite unadorned, and you just show people pristine images which kind of speak for themselves, which require very little in the way of decoration. You don't necessarily need to manipulate a reader or try very hard necessarily if you've got a kind of something very powerful that's happening, and you can just show the reader that. And there could be almost like a kind of tension there, because sometimes if something that's very emotionally charged and very momentous is being shown in a very kind of sparse, minimalist prose, for me as a reader, I sometimes have a very strong emotional response to that, because you want the writing to be very evocative and powerful and to try and make you feel a certain way, and the writing's not doing that. And then you're having to do that yourself, and that can make me very engaged as a reader. So I think that's a very useful technique. So when I say journalistic kind of novel writing, that's not a bad thing at all. The classic example, of course, is Ernest Hemingway, because he used the style guide from his first job as a small town reporter as his style guide for writing all those works of literature. And I always look out for this kind of writing. So basically, I suppose my question would be, why don't you just talk to us about the president's shop, how you arrived at this book, what you set out to do with this book?
It's interesting what you've said about the sort of teens being a kind of common theme between Bluebird and the president's shop. I think I'm interested really in those kind of in-between spaces. And I think being a teenager is really that, right? It's a kind of crossing over period where you're still alive to childhood, but you're also stepping into adulthood. So you've got this incredible insight into, and you're almost invisible too, because teenagers are in many ways invisible. No one kind of don't get taken very seriously, yet you participate in life in real ways. I always think it's a time of life where one's really alive, and it's a good time. And the teenagers don't have a great reputation in the UK. It's probably like my favorite kind of kids to be around. But the president shop came about because of my interest in the subject of belief. So what we believe in. And again, I think in a way it marks absolutely everything in life, right? What you as an individual believe in and what we as a collective believe in, and how we go about life with that belief. So there was something I understood, which is that the history of Yugoslavia as a country is very unknown these days, and the entire non-aligned movement, which was a really important part of 20th century history, is completely deleted. Nobody seems to know this. You talk to a 25-year-old today, they don't get taught about this. Of course, they get taught about the Cold War, but nothing else is sort of... But there was this massive movement of post-colonial nations who were becoming independent. There was a lot of free thinking, that what they call the Global South now, I think, is a sort of former Third World, and the Third World has become this sort of economic term. And so this entire movement has been lost, even though it still exists, the non-aligned movement, but it doesn't really serve any purpose as it used to. So I wanted to write about this country that came out of World War II as a socialist communist project that lasted for 45-ish years and had so much positive belief, actually, on the one hand, and was based on this, of course, adoration, worship of Tito. But I also didn't want to place it in a geographical location of Yugoslavia, because I didn't want to be hemmed in by actual history, you know. What I was really interested in were the parts of this project that were all about belief. So the original belief was to fight against the fascist invaders, which is all of the kind of facts-ish were based on actual research of that history. I saw a lot of documentary films. There's a lot of stuff sort of about how the partisans themselves, by basically stealing the weapons from the dead Germans, and then there was entire factories in Yugoslavia that were started with like copies of German. Well, you know, it was a real kind of grassroots guerrilla effort, and it liberated the country with the help of the Russians at some point at the end. But the partisan movement was really quite unique in this sense, because of the peasants who knew the mountains, so they had this great kind of advantage over the Germans at that time. And Tito himself was suddenly sort of recognized as great leader. And then he also managed to not go with the West or the East entirely. There were a lot of really positive things to it, in the way the country was built by voluntary action, a lot of like proper infrastructure was built by young people who just sort of wanted to do this. And that was a really, there were a lot of really positive things about Yugoslavia that never, they don't get talked about now. Post-war, it's all like terrible, blah, blah, blah. And so I thought the sense of belief in this project is really important. And then how that twisted, right? Suddenly the belief in this project was gone. There was the belief in another project of nationalism and war. And that was incredibly destructive, and works across the world. What do we stand behind globally, ideologically? What can we imagine as our rights? Do we believe in reasonable housing, or do we believe that we have to pay massive rent, right? How do we go around our lives in terms of what our ideological stances are? So that was a little bit what drove me to write The President's Shop, because there's these entire generations of people my mother's age are now in their 70s and their 80s who remember this time and lost. They've sort of been just completely undone out of any identity or rights, or, you know, we may have whatever you want to call democracy right now, but certainly in terms of living conditions, it's a much worse place to live. Bosnia, for example, Croatia, over 50 years ago. Yeah, that was my motivation.
Wow, thank you. Again, a few more things I want to touch on here then. One thing that you said it was based on research, and there was one kind of just passing kind of fact which occurred, which cropped up about the rule of 100-1, the partisans and the Germans. And I came across that same factor, 100-1, for every dead German, we will try and kill 100. People in a book in Belladonna by Dasa Drundic, and she wrote a book called Belladonna, and yeah, it talks about that exact same thing. So I was like, wow, I knew that bit. And yeah, the notion of belief is obviously one of the key kind of themes of the book, and how in a socio-political context like that, the state and the president and the head of state is like a surrogate for religion. So even this kind of project, which is fundamentally atheist at its core, it starts to resemble religion in some very fundamental ways. And it speaks to the sort of naivety of some of the radical atheism thinking that we see today, which somehow believes if you remove these stories and these kind of religious kind of stories, people won't create them again. You know, as if you stopped exposing people to religious ideas and religious beliefs, that way of thinking will disappear. And we see that doesn't happen. There seems to be some human drive to create narratives and believe,
well,
and this kind of thing.
Yes, I think we certainly need myth, right? This is part of our, as you say, a narrative, of creating a narrative, of understanding the world. It was interesting because this morning I was looking at Verso, the publisher, Verso, and they've just published a book by Tariq Ali about Winston Churchill as a sort of racist imperialist, which, yeah, of course, you can look at it beyond this sort of great myth of Churchill, right, in the UK, that this is what he was, right? But of course, Churchill is hailed as this kind of stiff upper lip British prime minister who saved the UK in World War II, and, you know, but beyond any of these sort of great mythical figures, there are layers of humanity. Power doesn't definitely come lightly. And yeah, so it's, we need all this stuff, whether it's Jesus or Churchill or Tito or whoever. There is, and one of the things that I remember very clearly was that, and I still feel this when I see a picture of Tito in his face, a family member, you know, like this is how ever present his face was. And in a way, it's why the book opens up with this sort of birth scene where his face is right there, because he was really everywhere. And it was never a negative feeling. It was like, oh, he's there. And he's sort of, it felt comforting. It's probably how religious people look at Jesus. I don't have this experience of any other face. So only after leaving Yugoslavia did I realize that this kind of thing existed in every society, but represented in different ways. Only kind of socialist, communist dictators get recognized, particularly in the West. You know, nobody sort of seems to think that their own ideological figures equal or at all similar to what you have elsewhere. It was an interesting kind of thing to think, oh yeah, of course, because I in Bluebird I was writing about this is a real life thing. My grandmother on my mother's side was Catholic, and she had a picture of Jesus and a picture of Tito next to each other because she saw them as equally, not because it wasn't enforced at all. She believed in both.
Great. So on that note, we're never going to get round to this reading if we keep talking, but you've touched on the book's opening with the birth in the president's shop. So let's then have the reading. Vesna is now going to read the first couple of pages from her recent novel, The President's Shop, available now on Shandorf Passage. So Vesna, please go ahead with the reading and feel free to just, you know, put any additional context in there if you feel it's necessary.
Okay, so I will read the first chapter from The President's Shop. Rosa pushed Mona into the world on a December evening, and as the infant emerged from the soft pink chamber of the womb at 7:13 p.m. under the luminous neon line of light on the ceiling, it was his countenance that Mona saw first. The president, as rendered in a black and white portrait in an ornately flowery gilded frame. It was as if the picture, or the picture frame, was the president's cell, and his figure, the cell's silent nucleus, floating around the country's interiors, watching all. The president was handsome, with high cheekbones that held his face taut like pegs pull a tent or wind yanks a flag. Mostly the pictures of him were black and white from his youth. Later, when Mona was nearing the first decade of her life, firm on her legs and lean in her body, the pictures of the president were in color, his aged countenance now full, sporting dark sunglasses, liver spots, and a military cap. Often in his autumn years, a Cuban cigar poked stiffly from between his canines. So my eyesight's getting worse. The doctor rushed in, perspiring and smelling of cigarettes and alcohol. He'd been drinking and smoking in a bar moments before being summoned by the panicked diet. Repeat this. Sorry. He'd been smoking and drinking in a bar moments before being summoned by the panicked Diogen, Ruben's younger brother, who had been helping Rosa in the shop. Rosa's waters broke across the floor, like in the movies, propelling her into the fastest labor known to womankind, as if Mona insisted she be born right there in the president's shop. The doctor, gypsy song still pounding in his head, arrived at the shop and found Rosa stretched out across the floor on top of the national flag, the five-pointed star beneath her. The baby was delivered upon it, curled like a wreath. The red star crowned her like an aura, a celestial body around the newborn, delivered from the heavens. Rosa was swollen and red, and the many globes of her body, the belly of vast sun, behind which nested the aureole of her breasts, radiated like circular echoes. Tears ran down Rosa's face. She looked down at the baby and smiled with her beautiful mouth. The umbilical cord pulsated between them. Thereafter, whenever they saw the doctor in the street, Rosa would say to Mona, "This is the man who birthed you," as if only the doctor had been the one to do the work of labor. The doctor always smelled of alcohol and cigarettes and glimmered with sweat like a silver birch.
I wanted to ask you about your work as a translator. So if you could maybe talk about your translation work.
My translation work is very new. And I have just translated the novel for Sandor Passage. And it's a Robert Perisic book. I don't know if you've read any of his work.
I've read of his work and he sounds like a really interesting author.
So I've translated some short stories of his before. I've never read a full, apart from the one I was in that I translated. And that's a really, if you have a chance to read it, it's a really lovely book. And I don't say this because I translated it. It's actually really one of those books that's just quite different. But that's quite a new thing for me. So I've translated a lot of samples for Sandor. So I have, over the years, I've translated a lot for Sandor in Croatia for the sort of different samples that they present. But I translated a sort of novella for them. And then for Sandor of Passage, this is the first book I've translated into English. And it was it was lovely. It was a great book to do. I am very much looking forward to working on the poetry of Maria Dejanović, who is Greece-based, Croatian-Bosnian poet. And I've translated a couple of her poems, so I'll translate the whole collection. And poetry is really my great love, which, of course, being so, difficult to anyway, yes, that's something I'm really looking forward to, and that's going to be happening this summer.
We could maybe talk a little bit about just the difference between the Croatian or the Bosnian language and the English language and how you negotiate some of those different expectations, maybe. I'm a translator too, so I'm quite interested in translation process, or just how you feel the different personalities and the different styles and the different kind of aesthetics of each language. I know you're bilingual, and I'm just interested in that experience and how your relationship is with your different languages. Do you feel like you have a different personality or a different identity when you're expressing yourself in a different language? Or what's your relationship to each of your languages that you work with?
This is a really interesting question because in many ways, to me, it's very intuitive. Sometimes it's really hard to break it down in words, which may sound strange for a writer, but there are things that are just not that easy to explain in words. So many times it's just going through a number of words until you get the one that feels right. No, I probably know English better than Croatian, shall I say that, weirdly, certainly in terms of literature, which obviously is the reason why I translate into English. But when it's about, sometimes I have to look up the words if they're particularly specific. But it's just a really intuitive process. It matters a great deal that you love the work that you're translating, no? That in a way that it's something that really interests you when it comes to literature, at least, and poetry, that it's not like translating any kind of text, and to be able to get the voice right. So, for example, I translated a chapter of, have you read Damir? He's a Croatian author. So I translated a chapter of his penultimate book, which is only 4 chapters. And it is it's minimal, but dense at the same time. And he's actually got a great use of humor in this incredible darkness of the setting of each of his books. But that was like a very kind of, Robert's book is really it's a lovely story. So the language is very simple. He just tells a great story. It's a great, really takes you with it. Whereas this other work was quite poetic, very stark, you had to really get it right. And that felt, sometimes in my spare time, I do some weaving on a tiny little loom. And it really felt like this, where you had to really get it right. You have to focus on each word in a particular way. So each text has its own requirement. I don't know if this resonates with your experience at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially the bit that you said about the process being quite intuitive, really. Because I feel it is. It's a very practical process. I did a master's degree in translation, and all of that theoretical approach to translation studies doesn't really serve you in practice. It's something about it just clicks. Sometimes you just feel like you've just nailed the right expression or something like this. So you found a neat way to untie. You know, I translate from Latinate languages, Spanish and Portuguese, which syntactically do very different things, which have like very complex run-on sentences with clauses and subordinate clauses and relative clauses, which you have to find a way to rework that in English, which as you can't really do that. The other thing that I was going to say was translating kind of quite stark minimalist prose actually being more challenging than you probably think it's going to be, because there's very little margin of error. It's very minimalist and stark, and you realize if an author's using a million different words to describe a thing, maybe that word's not right, but maybe it comes together later and maybe this bit can compensate that bit. But when there's not one syllable that's wasted in the original, you have to be exactly precise.
And I think for me, yeah, this is the best kind of writing, where this is one of the things about English that I realized that I never thought about before until I started translating, is that it doesn't suffer this kind of fluffiness very well. You cannot do it in English. Somehow, like, you don't even notice it. Whereas when you start translating, it's like, no, this sounds really, like, weird in English. So this is so I think stark kind of prose, apart from being something I enjoy anyway, but it's a much more kind of specific, detailed, meticulous work, which I enjoy.
Absolutely. I feel we could keep talking, but we've got our lives to live, so we should probably draw it to a close more or less here. Yeah, thank you very much, Vesna, for talking to us about your work as an author, as a translator. Vesna's novel, Dear President Shop, is available on Sandorf Passage. Bluebird, your memoir, is available too.
Also as an ebook. Which is quite handy, I think, these days, yeah.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This has been Bosnian UK author Vesna Maric in conversation with host Joe Williams. Vesna's novel, The President's Shop, is available now from Sandorf Passage. And her translation of Robert Perisic's A Cat at the End of the World will be out in November 22, also on Sandorf Passage.
Women in Translation is an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more. This series is executive produced by Trafica Europe Radio. Please sign up at our site to stay informed about upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.